what I want to talk about are Huebner points, which are these wonderful gadgets that have been used for all sorts of purposes in studying number theoretic properties of elliptic curves. So since the conference is about open questions, there will be some open questions. I mean, there are always open questions whenever one does something. But the main open question that I want to propose is to find uses for Huebner points in cryptography. Before I got here, I knew of one paper that did that, but very nicely, it turns out that the very next talk is going to talk about Huebner points in relation to cryptography, so there'll be another one just in a few minutes. So this talk can also partly be seen as an introduction to the next talk. So what I've talked about first are modular curves and what Huebner points are. The modular curve I'm going to use is x naught of n, which is a projective algebraic curve. But I don't really care about equations for it, or there's a complex uniformization people often use, but I don't even care about that. I simply care about the fact that points on x naught of m classify pairs, EC, where E is an elliptic curve, and C is a cyclic subgroup of order n in the elliptic curve. So I guess if n is composite, it's complicated. If n is prime, for a given elliptic curve, there would be n plus 1 possible cyclic subgroups. So you get sort of n plus 1 different possible Cs for a given E. And the nice thing is that, well, there are actually even rationality properties, which we'll get to in a minute.
Is this over any particular field?
No, not particularly. I mean, in vast generality, I guess it's a scheme over any ring where n is invertible, but we don't really need that. Anyway, I said it classifies isomorphism classes of pairs, parameterized isomorphism classes of pairs. So two pairs are considered equivalent if first the two elliptic curves are isomorphic, and second that isomorphism preserves the structure, namely it takes the one cyclic subgroup to the other cyclic subgroup. And written like this, one would say x naught of m is the solution to a moduli problem, namely classifying these pairs up to isomorphism, and as such, it certainly is a set, because there's a set of such isomorphism classes. But it turns out that, in fact, one can give x naught of m the structure of an algebraic curve. Actually, I've been cheating all through here, since some people realize I've been cheating. In fact, the set of pairs gives you sort of an affine algebraic curve, and if you want a projective algebraic curve, you have to add a few points, which are called cusps. And again, I'm not really going to worry about that so much. So you can think of points of x naught of n. Most of the points classify pairs like this, and a few of the points classify kind of the degenerate version. And even nicer, talking about possible fields of definition, if the point x is defined over some particular field k, then the elliptic curve is defined over k, meaning it has a Weierstrass equation with coefficients in k, and the subgroup is defined over k, which doesn't quite mean the points in the subgroup are k-rational, but the Galois produced those points. So C itself is a Galois-invariant subgroup. And this is all very, very classical. So what are Huebner points? Well, Huebner points are special points on x naught of n that are manufactured using some data. And the data is first a quadratic imaginary field, second, the ring of integers in K, which I'll denote by O, and third, an ideal in that ring of integers whose quotient ring is just Z mod nZ. Now, for a given capital N, there are conditions on how the primes dividing N have to split in O in order for there to exist such an ideal. And again, the primes in N need to split or ramify, I guess. But we're just going to kind of start with this setup. I also want to mention that this is sort of the basic ground level version of Huebner points. In general, instead of taking the full ring of integers, one can look at an order in K. And again, I'm not really going to use those, but the next talk will use them quite extensively. So you should think of this as a Huebner point is this or something like this. Now, since K is a quadratic imaginary field, we can think of it as sitting inside the complex numbers, and then the ring of integers of K is a subring of the complex numbers, and it defines a lattice. Namely, it's got two R independent points, and it, as a Z module, it has rank 2. So you can take the complex numbers and just mod out by this discrete subgroup, O, and that gives you an elliptic curve, at least over the complex numbers. In fact, this is how elliptic curves first came up, right, as the complex numbers modulo two independent periods, coming from the theory of complex analysis and looking for functions that had two independent periods, like trig functions have one. And given this setup, this elliptic curve actually has a cyclic subgroup of order n that we've kind of created, because if you take the inverse of your ideal, you know, there's just a fractional ideal, that fractional ideal modulo the ring of integers is a cyclic subgroup of order n, right, that follows from this. So that's a subgroup of order n contained in C mod O, in other words, contained in the elliptic curve. And that pair, so it's an elliptic curve and a cyclic subgroup of order n, more or less by definition, gives you a point on X mod of n. A complex point, admittedly, but a point. I'll denote C for the second. And I'll call that the Huebner point attached to K. Really, it should be the Huebner point attached to O, if you take something other than the full ring of integers. But that's what a Huebner point is. So they're not really that complicated to construct, at least in terms of complex numbers. Okay, there's a lot known about the arithmetic properties of Huebner points, and in fact they were studied in some sense long before Huebner started playing with them. So if you take a Huebner point attached to a quadratic imaginary field, the first thing one finds is that the field of definition of that point, so by K of C what I mean is X mod of n is an algebraic curve, so you think of that embedded in some projective space. And C is a point on that curve, so it has coordinates. And K of C is simply the quadratic imaginary field K with all the coordinates of C adjoined. So it's the field, smallest field where the coordinates of C live. And it turns out that field is the Hilbert class field of K, which is the maximal extension of K that's Galois with an abelian Galois group and unramified at all primes.
So if n is composite, there are going to be lots of different ideals with the right property. But you're talking about the Huebner point associated to K, and I'm wondering.
Oh, that's a good point. You're right. I'm sorry. Should be the Huebner point associated to K and Goth again. Absolutely. In point of fact, yeah. You're absolutely right. The Huebner point really only depends on the ideal class of the Gothic N. And different ideal classes give you different points. So in fact, you get H of K. And in fact, it's exactly this, that the Galois conjugates of C, they're H of K of them, and they exactly correspond to the different ideal classes. Yeah, good point. Thank you. Anyway, so the degree of the field generated by one of these Huebner points is the class number of the quadratic imaginary field K. And I assume everyone probably knows that that class number is more or less the square root of the discriminant. I mean, I'm cheating. It's the discriminant to the 1/2 plus or minus epsilon. So roughly it grows like the square root of the discriminant. It's the Brouwer-Ziegel theorem. And I'll just mention that there's a sub-exponential algorithm, of course, to compute ideal class groups and ideal and class numbers. So you can actually compute this degree in sub-exponential time. So that statement is kind of just the start of the theory of complex multiplication and Huebner points in them. And so you can use class field theory and the theory of complex multiplication to give a very, very explicit description of how the Galois group of this extension, which is abelian, because it's the Hilbert class field, and everywhere unramified, acts on the Hilbert class field. More precisely, you can give a very explicit kind of geometric description of how the Artin symbol on that Galois group acts on the Hilbert class field. And again, I'm going to throw in sort of an extra remark that if instead of taking the full ring of integers, you take an order, so a subring of the full ring of integers, then in fact you'll get things bigger than the Hilbert class field through the field of definition. You can go up whole towers like that. And again, that will play a role in the next talk, I believe. All right. The other thing that I wanted to talk a little bit about, because it kind of ties together with at least the vague thoughts I had for using some of this for cryptography or cryptanalysis, maybe, is the theory of Turing lifts, which I think is very closely related to the idea of the complex multiplication method that people have been using for constructing elliptic curves with good crypto properties, except kind of in the opposite direction. Namely, if you start with an elliptic curve over a finite field, which I'll assume to be ordinary to make life easier, and if you take a cyclic subgroup of its group of rational FP rational points, cyclic of order n, then again, by the modularity property, the fact that x naught of n is a moduli space, the pair, E tilde, an elliptic curve over FP, and a subgroup of its FP points, gives you a point on the modular curve defined over this finite field FP. All right, an elliptic curve over a finite field has an endomorphism ring. Since I assumed that the elliptic curve is ordinary, this endomorphism ring will be an order in a quadratic imaginary field. So if I let O be the endomorphism ring and I tensor with Q to get the fraction field, I get a quadratic imaginary field. This is just all standard stuff from the theory of elliptic curves. And again, I'm going to assume that the order that I get is actually the full ring of integers of K, which of course doesn't always happen, but frequently happens. And of course, you can compute, right? This is right. You see, I'm really not a computational person. I mean, if you count the number of points on the elliptic curve over FP, then you know the trace of Frobenius, and then you can, you can certainly figure out what this is, and you can figure out what the order is too, I guess. Also, so it's, like I said, what it was is it's easy to compute those things, meaning it's polynomial time, since they're polynomial time algorithms the number of points on the elliptic curve. And Turing's lifting theorem, which he proved, I believe, mainly as a tool for studying the L series of elliptic curves with complex multiplication. And it is a very, very influential paper from the 1940s, which unfortunately is in German, so I've never read in detail. But there's actually a Huebner point defined over the Hilbert class field of this quadratic imaginary field, K. And a prime ideal in the ring of integers of that Hilbert class field. So that if you take this Huebner point, C, and reduce it modulo that prime ideal, it's a split prime ideal, in fact, so when you reduce mod P, you get something in this field, F sub P. You get back to the original point, Huebner point, the original point on x naught of n that you started with.
Okay. So, sorry, just to make a clarification on the point, that you can make assumptions on such that the ring of integers would have to be, the randomizer would have to be the full ring of integers just based on z pi would be the full ring of integers.
Yes.
If not, they don't have polynomial time knowledge for actually computing the randomizer.
if it's in order. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So what I said wasn't quite right computationally. What certainly is true is if you pick a whole bunch of these at random, you can compute the action for Vanius, and if the discriminant of 4t minus ap squared ends up being square free, then you're golden and you have the whole ring of integers. So it's not hard to find these, but okay. So it's not easy to actually compute this exactly in general. Thank you.
In those cases where you don't have the full ring of integers, is the same theorem true for the ray class field?
Yes. Yeah, there's a whole. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But isn't another way to look at this is the set that Calhoun called it?
I'm sorry, is what?
This is the set that Calhoun called it.
Yeah.
So you can compute that theoretically.
Yeah, you can approximate it theoretically.
And then because it's an algebraic number, you know, there's a degree and so on.
Yeah, except for the fact that its degree is the class number, which is on the order of square root of pride, you can't actually write the thing down. If p is 3.62.
Is this just an existence theorem?
Yes and no. I mean, I think the Durang's proof will kind of describe for you the sort of complex analytically what you want, or as Lippert would say, I guess theoretically when you can do it, maybe that's better for computation. If you're asking whether it's effective, the answer is yes, it's certainly effective. Is it computationally feasible? Depends how big the numbers are. Okay. So that's a little bit about modular curves and what Huebner points are in modular curves and how you can lift FP points on modular curves to actual global points defined over Hilbert class fields. So now let me turn to elliptic curves. So let's take an elliptic curve defined over Q, pick whatever favorite elliptic curve you have. A modular parameterization of E is a finite covering map, so a finite morphism, from some x naught of n to the elliptic curve E, which I'm going to implicitly assume is defined over Q also. To be honest with you, there's no particular reason one would believe that these exist for very many elliptic curves. I mean, maybe for some, but in point of fact, the famous conjecture named after various people, where if you start giving names, you get in trouble, so I won't. Because luckily now it's a theorem. He was the main contributor to this, obviously, and then a number of other people finished it. If you take an elliptic curve over Q of conductor M, so N is more or less the product of the primes of bad reduction, maybe some of the squares, and 2 and 3 maybe or worse, more or less just the product of the primes of bad reduction, then E always has a modular parameterization, in fact, from the modular curve x naught of N, where N is the conductor. And that covering map is even defined over Q. Okay. So Wiles proved this, I guess, Wiles proved this in the case that the conductor actually is square free. So the case where there's only multiplicative reduction, and then various other people, and it was hard, finished all the other cases. But certainly Wiles' ideas were the fundamental ones. Now, in practice, if n is small, you can explicitly write down these maps. As small, if n is 11, in fact, the modular curve x mod of n already is an elliptic curve, so it's map of degree 1. If n is 13, I guess it's has genus 2, and it's not so hard to write down maps. And even up to, I'm not sure how far people have done it, but I would guess that n up to 100 or 200, one might well be able to get one's hand on in a reasonable sense. There's an article of Milnelke's talking about writing these things down. complex analytically, actually, it's even easier if you just want to approximate things. On the other hand, if n is of cryptographic size, then I don't think there's any hope in the world of actually writing down and explicitly working with one of these things, okay? So in fact, any application of maybe I should warn you now, what I'm going to describe is a possible way to solve elliptic curve discrete logs that does not work, okay? But I think it's an interesting idea anyway, so I thought I'd present it. It was a possible way to use Heapier points. But in any case, if you're going to use modular parameterizations in any computational sense, you're probably going to need an elliptic curve whose conductor is not too big, so that this map has degree that's not too big. But then again, people often use elliptic curves for cryptography whose coefficients are quite small, because you get a lot of savings in terms of computation if you take an equation that's small. All right. So for the remainder of the talk, what I'm going to do is fix this elliptic curve and fix a modular parameterization I'll call phi sub e. And if we take a Heapier point on x naught of n attached to some field k and some ideal Gothic n, then I'll call the image on E a Heapier point on E attached to k. And again, it should really be attached to that ideal that's giving you your cyclic subgroup also. Okay. So those are the Heapier points that I want to talk about, and they give you points on the elliptic curve. Now, since the field where the Heapier points are defined is this Hilbert class field, which tends to be pretty large if the discriminant of k is large, the Heapier point on E, this image point, also is going to have very large degree, since the degree is at least as big as the degree upstairs divided by the degree of the map. And I'm assuming that there's kind of a small, that phi sub e has kind of a small degree, okay? So just one way to keep in mind is that these points on these elliptic curves are defined over quite large fields. So the title of the talk, I think, was Independence of Heapier Points, and that's the theorem that I want to talk about. And if you like, it's kind of a theorem that gives a negative result in cryptography. But let me talk about just collections of Heapier points for a moment. One thing you can do, I mean, the Heapier points defined over this huge ideal class, Hilbert class field, okay? But you can always get points over defined over the rationals, for example, by taking the trace from that Hilbert class field down to Q. Sometimes you can actually get away with taking the real subfield of the Hilbert class field. But anyway, so that's just taking all the elements of the Galois group, applying them to the point and adding them up, and then it's obvious that's defined over Q, since Galois leaves it invariant because we've basically symmetrized with respect to the Galois group. And a very famous theorem of Gross and Zagier, which was extended by Gross, Zagier, and Conan, says that if you take every Heapier point, and there are a lot of them, that there are class number of k of them, and you take their traces, and actually that's not even quite what I want to say. If you take all Heapier points for all quadratic imaginary fields, for all ideal classes in all of those quadratic imaginary fields, and take their traces, the subgroup of E of Q that they generate has rank either 0 or 1. Okay. The really interesting, I mean, it's actually really easy to create points on elliptic curves defined over number fields whose traces generate subgroups of rank 0 or 1, because they'll always generate rank 0, in other words, you get nothing. The really interesting thing about traces of Heapier points here is that frequently you actually get a point of infinite order. And that was what Gross and Zagier did in their paper. They showed that that if the sine of the functional equation of the elliptic curve over Q was minus 1, then you know the L series vanished. What they did was they proved that the first derivative at 1 is equal to a rational number times the canonical height of a Higner point. Okay? So this is a special case of the Bertrand and Dyer conjecture. And it was, I mean, it was a major breakthrough. The weird thing is, if the elliptic curve has rank strictly bigger than 1, then the Higner point turns out to be trivial, just a torsion point. It's only in the case where the elliptic curve has rank exactly 1 that that the Higner points give something non-trivial. No one to this day knows how to produce rational points, q-rational points in elliptic curves when the rank is 2 or bigger in some way that really encompasses the arithmetic enough so that you can do things like try to prove Bertrand and Dyer.
So
okay.
If the rank of E is 1, you always get a point of infinite order?
Well, this kind of goes the other way. It says that if L prime is non-zero, then from that you can conclude the height's non-zero, from which you can conclude the Higner point has infinite order. Let's see, if the elliptic curve is known to have rank exactly 1, I don't even know. Well, then you can't go the other way, can you?
No. If you believe Bertrand and Dyer, you can.
I'm sorry?
If you believe the Bertrand and Dyer conjecture, then yeah.
Oh, well, if you believe Bertrand and Dyer, you can do any rank, right? You just can't get the point.
No, you can get the point of the Higner point.
Yes, yeah, sure. No, but I think the question is, if there's an elliptic curve and somehow someone told you that it had rank 1, would you automatically know that the Higner point was not trivial? I guess the answer is no. Okay. In a slightly different direction, I mean, this is where we're taking the trace all the way down to Q. But as I said, a reasonably natural thing to do once one starts looking at these is to look at Higner points defined over, well, the ring of integers of K and then a subring of that in order and then a smaller subring. And you get a whole tower of Higner points. What's not so clear is what to do with them. But it turns out if you impose certain norm compatibility conditions on them so that they form what I guess Carl's name for is an Euler system, then there are all sorts of applications of this to things related to elliptic curves. For example, proving that the Tate-Chaffer-Abich group is finite. So what you get is a whole tower of ring class fields, in fact.
That was Kolyvagin's name.
Oh, was it Kolyvagin? Okay, or Kolyvagin's name, Euler systems. Earlier, Carl was looking at the analogous case for the multiplicative group in some sense. Ideal class groups, right? Sort of.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, and again, I think these towers are likely to come up in the next lecture. Right? See, I'm really putting a lot of pressure on the next lecture, right? But in fact, the question I want to ask is rather different. Rather than taking a tower of fields, I actually want to look at distinct quadratic imaginary fields and take the Higner points of for the full ring of integers and choose some ideal in there. And ask whether those points are, whether those Higner points are independent. And they'll be defined over different fields, but you could have composites of some of the fields containing some of the other fields, so it's not entirely clear, I think. And under mild class number condition, which I'll tell you about in a minute, the answer is that yes, the Higner points are independent, which I think is an interesting fact, but it's probably good for cryptography, because if they weren't, there might be something one could do with them. So just to describe the main theorem, I need one piece of notation. If m is a positive integer, I'll write m odd for the odd part. I'll just divide out by all the powers of 2. Okay. And here's a theorem. An elliptic curve over Q that does not have complex multiplication. Let phi sub e be a modular parameterization, so that's just a covering x mod of m to e as before. Take a bunch of different quadratic imaginary fields and so K1 through KT, and let H1 through HT be their, excuse me, class numbers, and let P1 through PT be associated Huebner points, where, yeah, this is why I guess I didn't use that notation, put the ideal notation originally. What I mean simply is for each of these Ks, take the ring of integers, take any ideal that whose quotient ring is Z mod NZ, and then just take that Huebner point. I don't care which one. Then the theorem says there's a constant that only depends on the elliptic curve, well, on the modular parameterization you choose. So that as long as the odd parts of the class numbers are big enough, then the points are independent. And of course, the class numbers of quadratic imaginary fields go to infinity fairly rapidly. So if this odd thing weren't here, what this would basically say is there'd be a limit to how much dependency you could get. But even with the odd thing, in fact, the odd part should normally be most of the class number. Okay? So that's the theorem that I'm going to talk about. But let me first talk about why it gives kind of negative application to elliptic curve discrete logs. So just as a philosophical point, one natural way to try to solve elliptic curve discrete logs is to lift from finite fields to Q or to some number field, or for that matter, to some function field. In other words, to some global field. Okay? And certainly the index calculus for the discrete log problem for multiplicative group works exactly that way. You're lifting from FP to Q. What helps you in Q, of course, is that Q star not only has infinite rank, which is very nice, but it has a lot of generators that are relatively small, namely small primes. The problem with this approach is that E of Q has bounded rank. Mordell Bay group says there's some bound on the rank. And on the other hand, if you start lifting to E of Q bar, the number fields, then, well, the rank can get big, but then the points tend to be too independent of each other. Anyway, there have been quite a few attempts to do this. I'm guilty of one or two myself, using either elementary and sometimes not so elementary lifting ideas. As far as I'm aware, there's no practical algorithm to solve elliptic curve discrete logs based on the idea of lifting to global fields, even in some particular cases. I mean, like MOV does elliptic curves, certain classes of elliptic curves. And the elliptic curves that have P points, there's lifting to the formal group. Anyway, which is strange or not strange, as you wish. But a lot of people have thought about it. I don't think anyone's come up with any practical idea. Certainly, a naive lifting idea is not going to work. Okay, so someone needs to do something using some theory. So an initial motivation for the research that Mike and I were doing, this is my initial motivation, I guess, and then I roped Mike Rosen into helping me, was to use Huebner points during lifts and then Huebner points to try to solve the elliptic curve discrete log problem. If the Huebner points associated to distinct fields had any tendency to be dependent, then here's a rough idea how you could solve the discrete log problem. Take points over your finite field and pull them back to the modular curve. Well, of course, you can't always do that to FP, but if you choose a bunch of points, a reasonable percentage of them will be able to be pulled back over FP, so that's fine. Lift those points using Durang's theorem to points in X naught of Q bar, push them forward back down to E, find the dependencies over the global field. It's much easier to find dependencies of points defined over global field. You can either use descent theory or you can use the theory of canonical heights, and then finally reduce the answer mod p. And I actually, since this is a crypto conference and sort of an algorithmic conference, I wanted to give this algorithm that doesn't work in more detail, because the basic outline of what one wants to do is the same for sort of any lifting idea. And probably most people are familiar with this, but I don't know, maybe some people aren't. So the goal, of course, is you're given two points, S tilde and T tilde, and you want to find M, which is their discrete log. So first, lift the elliptic curve to Q. So just pick some equation with rational coefficients, well, the integer coefficients, and fix a modular parameterization. Now what you do is you choose a whole bunch of random integers, AI and BI, and you compute AI of S tilde minus BI of T tilde, where S tilde and T tilde are your initial points. So call those PI. Pull the PI tildes back, a certain percentage of them will pull back, to points defined over FP on the modular curve. Now we use Doring's lifting theorem to lift them to Q bar points. They're defined over certain Hilbert class fields, of course. Then we push those Higner points, which are now global points, back to the elliptic curve. We get all these points PI. And we use some sort of method, descent theory or the theory of canonical heights or something, to find a relation on those PIs. So you have a relation on a sum of a bunch of these. So when you reduce, when you reduce mod P, you get a relation on the sum of these. So unless you'll get some sort of relation like AS tilde equals BT tilde. And as long as you're not unlucky, in other words, as long as A is invertible modulo the order of your group, you can find M. And of course, if you choose the AIs and BIs at random, this is a randomized algorithm, with high probability you'll be able to do that inversion.
Do you know how to compute the modular parameterization mod P? It looks like you pulled back along with the modular parameterization mod P first and then lift it?
The modular parameterization you have over Q. Yeah. So you can reduce it by P so you know what it looks like. Then given an FP point here, yeah, just to check whether there's an FP point above. I'm assuming this map has degree at most maybe 10 or something, so it's easy enough to check if there's an FP point lying over it. I'm sure, a very standard idea. I don't know if that actually gets credited to someone long ago. All I know is the person who showed it to me first was Neil Koblitz, but I know it wasn't due to him, but he just kind of said, oh yeah, of course one does things like that. Anyway, two things about this, if it's going to work, and again, not necessarily this exactly what I've just said, which I'm going to show you it doesn't work, but something along these lines. First, E is going to have small coefficients so that N isn't too big. So the degree of this map tends to be about log N squared or something. Anyway, so you don't want N too big. So even if something like this were to work, it's not going to work for elliptic curves where you choose the coefficients randomly mod P. But it might work for curves that have small coefficients. So the sort of number field analogs of Koblitz curves. And in 5, you see, when you start doing these lifts, presumably to try to get points that are dependent, one should do things like only take points whose fields, K sub I, quadratic imaginary fields, have smooth discriminant and smooth class number. But again, in sub-exponential time, you can find sub-exponentially many of those, just kind of at random. And you can compute them in sub-exponential. The problem is you're not going to be able to compute the points, these points. You're not going to write them down because, they'll have 2 to the 80th digits in their expansions. Yeah, so one thing Grossaglie and Conan do, in some sense, they compute this canonical height without writing the point down, in some sense. So there may well be an algorithm there to let one do that. Similarly, just from properties of Higner points, you can get information about their reductions, modulo primes, and then kind of choose different m's and try to get relations mod m for different m's and then fit them together in the Chinese theorem. Yeah. But I don't actually never tried to make the final parts of this work because the first part didn't work. So how am I doing for time? Sketch of proof. Well, why don't I quickly sketch the proof of the thing, just to give you an idea of what goes into it. So here's the statement of the theorem. Remember, it basically says if the quadratic imaginary fields have class numbers whose odd part is big, reasonably big, then the points are independent. So just to set some notation, assume that they're dependent, and we'll derive a contradiction. And what I'll do is I'll take a minimal dependency, and let me write one of them on this side and the others on that side, and to each notation for the teeth one, the sort of one I've picked out, I'll drop a subscript on it. So let capital K be the compositum of the quadratic imaginary field. So this is just a Z mod 2 cross Z mod 2, so on, extension. CL of K is the ideal class group of this multi-quadratic field, and H sub I will denote the Hilbert class field of K sub I, instead of H sub K sub I, just to avoid an extra subscript. Okay, step one, the fact that N sub P is written in terms of the others means that the field generated by N sub P, on the one hand, it lives in H sub T, which is the field that Huebner point lives in. On the other hand, it lives in the compositum of these Hilbert class fields, which are the fields where the points on the other side live. And so it just lives in this intersection. So now I use class field theory and a bunch of idempotent relations to analyze the odd part of the ideal class group as a Galois module. And from that, you can get consequences about the Hilbert class fields that gives the desired result. So what I'm doing in one slide is sweeping under the rug, you know, four pages of calculation. But that's the basic idea, to analyze the ideal class group as a Galois module, given the fact you have kind of two different ways of looking at it. The second thing is that there's a constant so that if you multiply the point you're looking at by any integer m, the degree of the field doesn't go down very much. There are two parts to that. First is this kind of acute lemma. Suppose you have a subgroup of GL2, Z mod MZ, and a submodule of Z mod MZ squared on which gamma acts. So every element of gamma maps W to W. Okay. And suppose that the action of gamma on W is abelian. In other words, gamma 1, gamma 2 acting on W, it doesn't matter which order. Okay. Well, intuitively, somehow, if gamma is an abelian subgroup, that's fine. But if gamma is a big subgroup, it will be very non-abelian because this group is very non-abelian. And if W is large, then you know, the non-abelian nature of gamma will have to be reflected in the action. So somehow, you can't have gamma very large and W very large. And that's what this is saying. The size of gamma times the size of W to the 1/3 is bounded. And the proof's a kind of elementary linear algebra, but rather intricate. I mean, you only have to do the case where M is a prime power, but that's where it's a little tricky. The 1/3 can certainly be improved. But the proof gets even messier. And I have no idea what the best possible exponent there is. The second part is to apply Sayre's theorem that says that the image of Galois acting on all of the torsion points has bounded index. So that's a very deep theorem. And that's where we use the no complex multiplication assumption because it's not true for complex multiplication curves. The final three steps are just combining things. First, since the field generated by P can be written as the compositum of these two extensions, using the first two parts, you get that the odd part of the degree is bounded. Next, you have the fact the field generated by the Huebner point on x naught of n over its image on E has bounded degree. That's just because the map phi has bounded degree. And finally, you just combine steps one and two that tell you that the odd part of the class number, which is the odd part of the degree here, it's just, you just combine everything. Okay. So these last three steps are really just combining the other information. Okay. So, a couple final remarks, and in the theme of the workshop, open questions. Question one, is the condition that the ideal class numbers have large odd part necessary? I don't know, I suspect not, but our proof completely falls apart. I mean, there's sort of every third line, we're ignoring the even part of something. On the other hand, this condition, the HI odd being greater than C, is true for most quadratic fields. After we've proven this, the analytic number theorist, Sundararajan, usually goes just by Sound, was visiting and then, well, actually no, it was before he visited. Anyway, by email, we're chatting with him. I mean, what he proved is that if you look at quadratic imaginary fields whose discriminant is at most X, and ask for the ones whose class number has small odd part, well, the number of fields that discriminate less than X is a multiple of X. And so what he does here is he more or less saves a log X here. So the ones with small odd part have density zero. Okay. Probably the right conjecture is that it should be less than square root of X, or X to 1 half plus epsilon or something. But no one can prove anywhere close to that. And as usual, less than means less than or equal to a constant times this. This is the analytic number theory notation, which I guess is different from the computer science notation. A couple additional questions. Is the condition that the curve not have CM necessary? Again, probably not, but Serre's theorem isn't true, but you do know, in fact, what the action of Galois looks like, actually much better in the CM case, but one would have to go through the proof, so we haven't done that. And it would be interesting to prove analogous results for Heitner points associated to non-maximal orders, so going up the class field tower. What about Heitner points in cryptography other than this one failed attempt I just showed you? Well, Heitner points and Turing lifts are really very important in the arithmetic theory of elliptic curves, used for all kinds of things. They're very powerful tools. So it seems that they should provide useful tools for studying cryptographic type questions, computational related questions. The one, as I said, I was aware of one example in the crypto literature. David Cole wrote an article about using the AGN method on X node of M, using Heitner points in lifting to get an elliptic curve point counting algorithm, which I've never really looked at in detail, so I don't know if anyone who does point counting actually knows what's in this paper. No. Okay. But in any case, it has Heitner points in the title, so I assume it uses Heitner points. So the final thing that I wanted to mention was an idea of Heitner points for real quadratic fields. Because as we just saw, Heitner points associated to imaginary quadratic fields pretty much are always independent of each other. Well, Henri Darmon has this absolutely amazing idea where he attaches Heitner points to real quadratic fields. Okay? Most of the results are conjectural. Even the fact that the points are algebraic is conjectural. But experimentally, everything seems to work beautifully. What he uses, because I didn't really resonate. I mean, the standard construction of the modular curve is the upper half plane modulo gamma naught of n. That maps to x naught of n of C, and then we map that to the elliptic curve. Darmon kind of replaces this with a p-adic upper half plane, and ultimately he uses Tate's p-adic uniformization. So in fact, the prime here is not a cryptographic prime. The prime here is a prime where E has multiplicative reduction, so it would tend to be a small prime, which is fine. You can think of it as being the analog of working over C here. Why might this be useful? Well, conjecturally, these Darmon-Heitner points are very similar to classical Heitner points. They satisfy conjecturally, a lot of the same properties. They generate class fields, and the Galois group acts by the Artin symbol the way you want it to. So the theory looks very similar. In particular, remember that the Huebner points are defined over the Hilbert class field of your quadratic field. And quadratic imaginary fields, the Hilbert class fields get huge. They have to. They grow like the square root of the discriminant. But real quadratic fields, that's not true anymore. There are lots and lots, everything's conjectural. There are conjecturally lots and lots of real quadratic fields of class number one. In fact, there's supposed to be like 67% of them?
75%.
So that's really a lot. So I that's close enough to all of them that we can pretend they all have class number one. So they're easy to find. So if you take a real quadratic field of class number one, and if the elliptic curve, its sine of the functional equation is odd, which conjecturally means it has odd rank, the Mordell Bain group has odd rank for Bertrand and Dyer, so you can think of it that way instead. Then, you see, the piece of K, the Huebner point, Darmon's Huebner point, lives over the Hilbert class field of K. But class number is 1, so that's just K. But the sine of the functional K equation being minus 1 means it actually lives in the real subfield, which is Q. So in fact, under those conditions, the Huebner points actually live in E of Q. It's easy enough to do in practice, to write a bunch of these down. If you write down a bunch of these Huebner points, which have a 75% chance of having class number one, so you throw out the ones that don't, they'll all be in E of Q, and as long as you find more of them than the rank of E of Q, then they're automatically dependent. The computations that Darmon and some of his co-authors have done, you can see this happening. He gets points in E of Q when E of Q, I think all of his examples, E of Q actually has rank exactly 1, 5. And you can see you get several, you take a bunch of different Ks and you get various multiples of that 1 point. So why not do that lifting algorithm I described earlier, the Dorning-Huebner lifting algorithm, using instead these Darmon-Huebner points, where you will get them to be dependent. What's lacking is there doesn't seem to be any Dorning lifting theorem, or at least none that anyone has found. On the other hand, Darmon's stuff is only maybe 10 years old at that, and I don't know that people have looked so much. I asked Darmon, and I also asked Samit Dasgupta, who worked on this stuff, and their first impression was they didn't see any natural way to do a Dorning lifting thing in their context, because they don't really have an x naught of n sitting anywhere. Nonetheless, I'd like to leave that as, if you want a specific open problem, would be to try to find some sort of Dorning lifting method for these real quadratic Huebner points, which might then have applications to cryptography, in particular to the elliptic curve discrete log problem.